This is Bronwyn Schwagert, licensed therapist and author at the Angry at the Right Things podcast. Instead of controlling our anger, we'll be looking at what causes it in the first place so we can rectify what's dysfunctional in our lives and in the world. Here we go. Hey everyone, thank you for tuning in to us today at Angry at the Right Things. I have my bestie, Katie Wander, here with me. And we just have so much to talk about. We don't even know what we're going to talk about. I have some things I want to talk about. And I'm so grateful, I just want to say, for Katie, because I am a therapist, but I don't have a therapist. And she's kind of my therapist, not in that she gives me advice, but she is very much a listening ear with loads of empathy and validation for me. And you know, I'm kind of doing this podcast in part because A, I found that maybe 90%+ of all therapists really suck, to be honest, because they don't do those things I just shared that are so vital for emotional and mental health. And I want those who listen to be able to bypass the therapist if needed, because a lot of them are really horrible. And if you are a therapist listening, I want to help empower you to know what to do as a therapist, because I myself, when I was an intern for those 3 years, I really didn't know what I was doing. I really didn't know. And there's a lot of really, in my humble opinion, very bad therapeutic modalities that are being pushed on therapists, supposedly are evidence-based. If you do the research, they're not, as in not long-term. Maybe they have very short-term positive outcomes, but long-term they don't. And what people really need is what I have with my friend Katie, which is a listener, someone who gets to know you. You can't help someone you don't know. And knowing takes time and it takes lots of listening. And Katie has been like that for me over many years, and I appreciate her now more than ever. I'm hoping that everyone has someone, at least one person in their life, who is this person for them. And maybe we don't have to go out and pay all the money for a therapist.
Wow, I'm super flattered, and you can't see me right now, but I'm definitely blushing.
Oh,
that's super, super sweet. I really appreciate that and feel the same way.
Thank you. Yeah. So, yeah, I actually just spoke with an old friend of mine that she and I were in our graduate program to become therapists together. That was how many years ago? I mean, we were in grad school, yeah, over 10 years ago together.
That long. Wow.
Yeah. And she's my age. A lot of the graduate students were really young, like fresh out of college. So we were in our 40s. We were older. We were married with children. We kind of trauma bonded over all of that. And she's fantastic. Her name's Caroline. And I had not talked to her prior to yesterday for years. And it was really lovely. I just reached out to her and emailed her the other day. I had to Google her and found her on Psychology Today website. And I reached out through their website to her. And we just scheduled to talk on the phone. And we finally did that yesterday. And we spoke for like an hour. And it was so lovely. And we actually joked about CBT and DBT therapy and therapists, and how we've both found as therapists that A, those modalities really kind of suck, and B, a lot of our clients that come to us have been somewhat traumatized by those kind of therapists that use them.
Hmm. Remind me again what?
Oh yeah, sorry.
CBT and DBT.
Yes. So CBT stands for Cognitive Behavioral Therapy.
Okay.
And I'm not saying it's all bad. Please don't hear that. I don't think it's therapeutic, but I don't think it's all bad either. So cognitive behavioral means you're looking for what that person's thoughts or their cognitions are, and you are actively trying to change those thoughts or cognitions. So if I hear like a theme, if you're sitting there talking and I'm hearing you, you know, say, I don't think my daughter loves me kind of thing, I would, you know, work to change that. Maybe if I listened well, I could do it pretty well. But see, the listening piece is, again, key. You know, over time, if I really got to know you and listen to you, I could do a really good job with changing, helping to reshape or restructure your belief about your daughter loving you. But if I only sit with you one session and only listen to you for 15 minutes, you're not going to really believe my my new framing of your belief or cognition, right? Does that make sense?
That makes sense. Yeah.
And so that's the C in cognitive behavioral therapy. And then the B is behavioral. So, you know, you're coming in and telling me your daughter hates you and you're really depressed and you're not leaving the house, then the behavioral part is me trying to get you to leave the house usually.
Okay.
And telling you to go to the gym or to take a walk or, you know, that kind of thing.
Like redirection.
Yeah.
Okay.
And again, those things, neither one of them are bad, but it depends how well I know you, especially the cognitive piece. If I don't really know you and I say something like, you know, I've listened to you for all of 15 minutes and I say, oh, you know, your daughter's 18. That's just how 18-year-olds are, you know, or I try to reframe it, but I'm not really knowing you and I'm not really knowing the history with your daughter and why this is – why you're having that perception, then you're not really going to believe me and that's not really going to work.
Right. Like it's not getting to the heart of the issue.
And I'm also invalidating you, aren't I?
Oh, right. Good point. Like just, oh, don't think that. Think this.
I mean, it can be that bad. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, a lot of CBT is that bad because if you're only seeing the therapist once every 4 to 6 weeks and the therapist is like, who are you again? What's your problem?
Right.
You just opened up your heart to me last time, but I don't know who you are now. I don't remember you. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yes.
And then I'm now dismissing
your
feelings altogether. Do you see why that could be a little traumatic for some
definitely clients? Definitely. Absolutely. Because it's probably someone that already feels dismissed in some way.
Yeah.
If they're hurting.
Yes.
That.
So that is, that's a really, I'm making it kind of overly simplified, obviously, to make a point or an illustration here with CBT. But that is, unfortunately, sometimes what happens. Also, if you're coming in and telling me your daughter hates you, but I'm not really getting to know you or the situation, because again, that would require a lot of listening and asking you good, open-ended questions, right? Mm-hmm. On my end. And what if I had really listened to you and found out, well, you're making your daughter sleep in the same bed as you, and you're not feeling safe to open up and share that with me because you don't know me yet, and I'm not really listening to you in the first place. But like, what if over time I finally do figure out, oh, well, of course her daughter's acting like she hates her because this is a mother who thinks her 18-year-old daughter should be sharing the bed with her, right? So there's a reason for all this, but I'm not going to learn that reason if I'm not invested in you, in listening to you, in validating your experience and your feelings and becoming a safe person for you to share something like, well, I think it's normal for my 18-year-old daughter to share the bed with me. Well, you have to trust that I'm safe enough to open up to, and that takes time.
Yes. Fear of being judged. It's very hard to be honest if you think you're going to be judged. That makes sense. And so CBT, how does that differ from
DBT?
DBT, yeah. What is that?
DBT stands for dialectical behavioral therapy, and that's basically a lot of like emotional regulation skills and mindfulness. Most people are familiar with mindfulness. So So a good example of DBT skills that are used for like teens that do self-harm. Okay. So that's like DBT is really famous supposedly for working with teens with self-harm, right? So if I have a young person come to me who's like self-harming in some way, a DBT skills therapist would say something like, well, you can just, whenever you want to self-harm, you just need to, Katie's phone's going off. It's okay, Katie.
Sorry about that.
I kicked the dogs out of the room, but now your phone's going off. It's always something. So a DBT skills therapist would, if I'm learning that you're my client and you're self-harming or at risk for it, I would say, you know what? If you're feeling that way, you can just go into your freezer and get some ice and hold those ice cubes for a period of time. And that's a really good way to help regulate your mood instead of self-harming.
Oh, okay.
Those are called DBT skills.
I see. Okay.
And mindfulness is similar in, I might say, you know what? Well, we talked about, even though I don't think it got recorded last time, but we talked about the therapist who spent my whole session telling me to just really feel my legs and really feel the muscles in my legs and be thankful for them and feel the earth or the floor beneath my feet and be grounded into the floor. So that's mindfulness. It's just like just really being in your senses, whether that's feeling the skin, your the sun on your skin or the wind. Those are cool things. I like those. Or feeling, you know, in your body and just being mindful and incorporating your senses. Again, now those things aren't bad, but do I find them therapeutic? No, I don't.
Okay. And what would you, when something qualifies it as therapeutic, what does that mean to say if something's therapeutic?
Therapeutic would be like healing. And that's kind of how I view therapy as healing. So if, you know, I have someone come to me with self-harm, the way I view humans as innately relational, like we're not, so DBT and CBT kind of view humans as, well, CBT, the cognitive behavioral, views us as more rational. If you change your thoughts, you change your feelings, you change your behaviors, you change the person. Like it's really, we're that simple.
Okay.
And then DBT kind of seems to view us as very individualistic and very isolated. Okay. Like if you just, you know, all you need to do is hold some ice cubes and, you know, get into your body and feel your senses, right? But I don't think those work. I don't think they're therapeutic because we are innately relational. And if someone comes to me and says, I'm struggling with self-harm, the first thing in my mind is to say, who are you really, really angry at?
Okay.
Tell me about that. And let's get to the root of why you're wanting to self-harm, which is the suppressed anger in your body that you're taking out on yourself instead of managing your symptoms by telling you just to feel some ice or feel your feet.
Okay. I see what you're saying. So those skills aren't necessarily like the DBT skills or the CBT. They're not necessarily unuseful. They're just not. They're like tools for using in the moment, but they're not going to like get to the root of the problem.
Yeah, I guess you could put it that way. I don't even know if they're that effective tools in the moment.
Okay.
But yeah, that's how they're built. But yeah, they really bug the hell out of me, to be honest, because it's kind of like treating humans like we're robots in a way. That's how I see it. Yeah. So, which kind of brings me to another thought that I wanted to talk about today. Depression and anxiety and panic attacks and mania and all those things are not, they don't just happen. They don't just happen. If someone says, oh yeah, I've just always struggled from depression, the first thing that that comes to my mind is, no, you were raised in a family where you were really angry about the way you were treated, and rightfully so. And that's why you're telling me you've always struggled with depression. So depression, anxiety are rooted in real problems. They're always relational, and they're always rooted in some type of suppressed anger from a relational problem.
Okay.
Always.
Always.
Always. In my mind. Yeah, always.
So some kind of lack or miscommunication or something between another person.
Well, I would go a little more extreme there. And we've discussed this before. I would say more a feeling of betrayal or abandonment.
Okay.
By someone.
And those are often, do you think, subconscious?
Do you think? Yeah, I do. And so I wanted to share some examples of my own life where I now am able to look back and say, oh my God, I sank into a pit of depression and I didn't know why at the time. But looking back, yeah, I felt completely betrayed or abandoned every single time. And I've had some very big prolonged depressive episodes in my life over the course of years. And I've had very instantaneous ones where I could literally, the best word is sink. I literally felt myself sinking into depression in a matter of minutes. So I thought I would share about my own journey.
Oh, yeah.
Please. And reflections now that I'm not depressed.
Okay.
So we talked about this one when we had to move in 2010. My family, my husband and my daughter, who was 5 at the time, we had to uproot and move from Sacramento to Oakland. And I, you know, that was when my daughter was starting out school and my husband, you know, had to get a job in this in San Francisco. I had nothing to do all day. I knew no one, and I was 100% alone, and I was the most loneliest I've ever been in my life. And I fell into a very profound depression to the point where I was literally throwing up randomly. Did you know this?
No.
You didn't know that?
I didn't know that.
Oh, wow. I thought you knew that.
No, you never shared that.
I was throwing up randomly. I wasn't intentionally throwing up. I remember walking down the street and just heaving and throwing up on the street. I remember driving my car and I couldn't pull over. I didn't have time, like throwing up on my lap while I'm driving. This is really gross, but I did.
Wow.
That's how bad my depression was.
Would you be crying first?
No.
No.
So depression isn't sadness. That's the thing. We term it as sadness and we have feelings of sadness, but it's not sadness.
Okay.
It was so much worse than sadness. And it's almost like a numbness to your sadness.
Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. It was debilitating. I felt absolutely purposeless and useless. I had this, you know, homeschooling community here in Sacramento before we left. I lost every bit of community. I lost feeling of purposeness. And like I put my daughter in school when we moved there. I knew no one. Like I said, I had no purpose. I was still working, but like a few hours a week. It was horrible. I'd never felt so alone in my life. But the interesting part is what made it the worst looking back is I felt completely abandoned emotionally by my husband.
Really?
Steve.
I didn't know that.
I didn't either. Until recently.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah. At the time, you weren't aware of that.
No.
Okay.
I have this memory of after we moved, we put Edie to sleep. It was one night. It was maybe 7:30, 8 p.m. We were sitting on the couch. And I just remember us staring at each other. And I remember thinking, I don't know if I want to stay married to this person. And it was the first time I'd ever thought that or felt that way.
Wow.
I felt at the time like he's thinking the same thing. I don't know if that was true. But here I was struggling, more lonely than I've ever felt. And I felt completely unattuned to by him, my husband of, at that time, you know, almost 20 years.
Wow.
So yeah, I just remember sitting on the couch, us staring at each other, and just feeling no love on my end. And I felt like he felt no love on his end. And I just remember going, is this going to work? And now looking back, I realized that I wasn't just struggling because of my circumstances. I was struggling because I felt like a stranger to my own husband. And I felt really abandoned emotionally by him. And that depression was really profound. I came out of it. I got into grad school. I, you know, felt like I had a purpose and a mission, and started making friends, and things got a lot better. And then the second depression, which we've talked about recently, happened when I was in my internship. First, we call it placement. At my first internship, placement was at this counseling center. And my supervisor, who was also the clinic director, I felt completely dismissed by him. I was thinking through my feeling words list, actually, earlier today. The feelings, when I think back to that time, the way I felt with him. So he was my boss, so to speak. He was a therapist. He was my supervisor. What I expected to feel was kind of attuned to, like cared for. Mm-hmm. Like he listened to me, like he cared about me.
Mentored, right?
Yeah, like, mentored.
Yeah.
I did not feel that way at all. I didn't feel that way from the look in his eye when we met, but I wasn't aware of all this. Now I am aware of it. Looking back, I'm like, yeah, the way he looked at me, I didn't feel, I think I felt really unimportant. And unwanted. Yeah. He didn't listen to me when I said, I don't want to take on a couple. I'm not ready for a couple as my very first client. He dismissed that. He wouldn't let me wiggle out of that. I felt, even by the look on his face, though, I just felt every time we met for supervision, I just felt like kind of rejected.
Right. When you really were wanting to feel like he's glad you're there and he's going to shepherd you through the process of learning to become a therapist. Right. And
yeah,
you got the exact opposite of that.
I felt very unimportant, unseen, unattuned to, uncared for, dismissed, kind of ignored.
Right.
Almost.
And how horribly ironic is that for someone that's becoming a therapist?
Yes. And it was very much, now looking back, I can see why that affected me so much, because I felt like that my whole life with my mother. So now I'm being triggered with those same feelings of kind of betrayal or feeling unimportant, unwanted. And I was angry, but I sunk into depression because I didn't advocate for myself. I didn't say, you know what, this is screwed up. I'm getting the hell out of here. Like, this isn't good. I didn't do that. I didn't see it. I didn't have that level of awareness. I didn't even know I was angry.
Right.
I didn't know I was feeling abandoned or betrayed. I didn't know that. All I knew is that I rapidly sank into a very profound depression again.
Okay. And what do you think, what has allowed you now, looking back, to see that, to see that you were angry?
Because now I see that anger, and especially, again, especially abandonment, emotional abandonment or betrayal, is at the heart of all, I believe, not only depression and anxiety, but almost all, you know, it's all relational. I see that now. It's at the heart of all mental illness. I really believe that. Attachment.
Wow.
And I'm able to, you know, connect those dots now because I see it in my clients over and over and over again. I mean, when they tell me I had a panic attack, the first thing I'm thinking is, what were you angry at in that moment that you couldn't express with boundaries and assertiveness? And there's always something. And I have connected the dots thousands of times over with my own clients that there's no, you know, there's no other connection for me now. I just see it so clearly. And now that I see it so clearly, I'm looking back in my own life and going, oh my God, every time I've struggled with depression, I can now see I was angry at feeling betrayed or abandoned emotionally by someone in my life that I felt like really should have attuned to me. Not someone cutting me off on the freeway, because you can't feel betrayed by someone who's a complete stranger.
Right.
These are all by people like my husband or my clinical supervisor that I felt like should have attuned to me and cared for me, and they didn't.
Right. Okay. The pieces are kind of clicking together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then after that, oh my God. And so when I, going back to my phone call with Caroline, who's she was just telling me a little bit, because she had a different internship placement. She stayed at one place for all her 3 or 4 years.
Okay.
And I always thought, looking back, I thought, oh, she found a great placement. I wish I ended up there. Well, it wasn't. She said it was really dysfunctional. Well, mine were also very dysfunctional. I think it's just people who go into the, well, okay, I think it's germane to all humans to be dysfunctional, but there's something about people who go into becoming therapists that you really find a lot of dysfunction. But my other placement, so when I left that one finally,
yes,
I went to one, I think you know the story more about this one, where the clinic director was someone who was my friend at the time. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
She was a friend of mine. I knew her from church, and I liked her, and she was the clinical director. I got a supervisor. He was the most dysfunctional person I've ever met in my life, like who was like somehow employed. He was a licensed therapist, and he was my new supervisor.
Great.
Yeah. But you know, I didn't super feel betrayed by him, because I never felt like – I never expected
– You didn't have expectations of him.
Yeah.
For some reason, he
kind of emanated asshole from every orifice. Okay. Wow, that's really poetic what I just said. But yeah, you kind of saw it coming with this guy. But he was next level. He was a licensed therapist. He seemed to really get some perverse pleasure in humiliating me.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you went from being unappreciated,
dismissed,
unwanted and dismissed, to being victimized.
Humiliated. Yeah.
Yeah.
I felt like he was really enjoying humiliating me and finding fault with everything I did.
Wow.
And I thought it was just me.
Talk
which
about
is
dysfunction. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. I thought it was just me. I spoke to, there was a man who was an intern there too at the same center where I was, and he was older than me. He was about to retire, or I think he had just retired from his career, and he was training to be a therapist, like as a retirement career.
Okay.
So he was probably in his 60s, and he found out who my supervisor was. And he said, oh yeah, he was my supervisor for a while. But he said, Bronwyn, out of all the supervisors I've ever had my entire life, I've never had anyone that dysfunctional. And then he told me, before you came on, there was another intern who hated him and basically told the clinic director, "It's you either fire him or I'm leaving." And she ended up leaving.
Wow.
And so that was really helpful for me to hear. And then I told the clinic director, who had been my friend before I became the intern there. Mm-hmm. And she looked into it and she did fire him, but she never admitted any – she didn't admit it. She kind of BS'd it and said, oh, he got promoted his job and he's no longer needed here.
Wow.
Yeah. But she looked into the things I had shared. I know she talked to those other people. So she did not own it. She didn't apologize. But the worst thing that contributed and fueled this depression of mine more than anything was, do you remember that I told you he – okay. So one of the clients I had at the time, she was a young woman who attempted suicide.
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So when she was coming to me, between our sessions, she attempted suicide and she was hospitalized. That supervisor, that horrible, horrible supervisor,
yes,
blamed it on me.
Wow, that's so irresponsible.
He actually said it's because I recommended she read a DBT skills workbook, which again, DBT is that's what it's notorious for, is helping people with suicidal ideation and self-harm.
Wow.
I recommended she buy a DBT skills workbook because I knew she was suicidal and I was scared for her and I was scared for – I was just starting out. I was still a trainee, so I wasn't even an intern at this juncture yet. I was scared to death. My supervisor, I didn't feel like I could trust him. And then when she actually was hospitalized, he blamed it on me for my irresponsible recommendation of a workbook that is actually for helping people with
– That is so
– Yeah.
Beyond horrible.
So he got canned, but here's the thing. The clinic director, the one who had been my friend, agreed with him in his assessment that
– It was your fault.
Yeah. She pretty much said
– Wow.
That was my fault. So do you know how angry I was at that time?
Oh, I can't even imagine. That is such a betrayal.
It was such a betrayal.
They both showed zero integrity.
I know. And I thought I didn't think she would. Yeah, I expected a lot more from her. I was so angry and it all just went inside my body and made my depression so profound because I didn't advocate for myself. I didn't say, you know what? Fuck you. That's what I should have said.
Right.
I really should have said that.
They were cowards. That's what they were. That's.
Yeah. At the very least. Yeah. Some kind of sick bully. Yeah. Who derives pleasure from other people's pain.
Right. Well, and they didn't want to take responsibility for that. Right. So they put the blame on you.
But she didn't have to say that. She told me, she said, yeah, before this young woman attempted suicide, they said she was reading a book you recommended. That's what she told me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I didn't have the ego strength back then to say, you know what? Fuck you.
Right.
That's a bunch of bullshit. That's not even technically possible.
No.
What are you talking about?
No, it's absurd.
I didn't have the strength to do that. And so all that rage at that accusation, that the insidious, you know, comment just went inside of me and I became so, so depressed.
Oh, it's so tragic.
Yeah. So anyway, those are my long-term depressions that lasted years. Those were two and they both happened in Oakland, which is why I'm so glad to not live in Oakland anymore because I just – it's all in my mind. It's just all connected. But I also have some examples of short-term depressions that I fell into that happened over minutes, like where I felt myself sink very, very quickly. One of them is a really negative story, but the other one actually has a positive outcome. So I wanted to share this.
Okay.
Okay. So the first one, both of them involve my mother. So the first one was, and I've shared this with you before too, Katie. It was Christmas Eve day. So my daughter was probably seven. So that was probably 12 years ago. and Steve, and we, Steve and I and my daughter Edie, were visiting my parents, and it was Christmas Eve. And my mom was mad at me because she felt like I was dismissing her, which I kind of was, to be honest. But anyway, she raged. She went into a complete rage. She tried to attack me, and she pulled out all the cords of the computer that I was on at the time because she felt dismissed because I wasn't like looking away from the computer, and she really wanted me to look at her and give her 100% of my attention at that point. And I was refusing to do it because this whole dynamic has been played out a million times in my lifetime with her. Anyway, so she was pulling out all these cords of the computer in a violent fashion, yelling and screaming. And then she left the room, and this was at her house. And I started crying, like bawling. And I couldn't stop. And it was also time to get in the car and drive for the Christmas Eve late lunch that we had reservations for as a family to do that day.
Okay.
And I couldn't stop crying. I couldn't pull myself together. I wasn't going to be able to join on that meal, for that meal, and just pretend like everything was fine. And I remember my daughter Edie looked at me and was like, oh my, like her eyes got big. She saw me crying and she's like, are you okay? And I'm like, no. And my mom and my dad just pretend like nothing happened, which, you know, again, is pretty routine for them. And Steve, my husband, what does he do? He looks at me. He sees me crying. He sees that I can't get it together. And he said, okay, well, if you can't join us, we'll be going to lunch now.
Right.
And I felt so abandoned by him.
That makes sense.
So the crying part, I didn't feel depressed. I just felt like angry at my mom and sad. But my husband choosing to make my parents happy over choosing to be with me made me feel betrayed and abandoned. And I quickly sank into a very profound depressive episode immediately when he went with them.
Right. And how long did that last for?
I know it lasted the rest of the day because then I'm alone at my parents' house and they're out to lunch on Christmas Day. So I called my friend Jen and I end up having Christmas Eve dinner with her family at her house. And that was just so bizarre. And I was depressed the whole time.
Oh, I think I remember that story.
Do you remember that? Yeah, that's a whole nother story.
Yes.
So that was that. But then I was thinking there was this other time where something similar happened where my mom, let's see, this wasn't that long ago. This was probably just a few years ago. So we were, my mom, my dad, Edie, and my husband, Steve, we were out to lunch with my parents, visiting them again. And my mom, well, long story short, she publicly humiliated me by manipulating me and taking away a key from me that my dad had just given me to a security box.
Right.
And she deceived me by taking it away, and she hid it, and I was just, there was nothing I could do, and she was refusing to give it back. And we're out at lunch, and I can't express my anger, and I'm so angry. And I remember, this wasn't that long ago, I started sinking, like that feeling of sinking into a depression. I just felt this sinking, like feeling, sensation. And Edie at the time, so she's 19 now, so she was probably 15 or 16. All of a sudden I'm sinking and I hear her laughing.
Right.
And she's sitting right across from me. And she's looking me in the eyes and she's laughing. And she doesn't say anything. And you know what? She didn't need to, because looking in her eyes and hearing her laughter, what I was getting from that was her saying, your mother is so crazy.
Right.
And that's all I needed.
Like, she saw you.
She saw me.
What you were feeling and the absurdity of your mother's behavior.
Yes.
Yeah.
I wasn't alone this right. time.
Right.
I wasn't you alone in my...
on your side.
Not even in my side as in like, you know, mom, you know, you've got this. Like, not in that no. kind of way. Just like, I had a witness. Mm-hmm. I wasn't alone in my feelings. And I... went from starting to sink into this. I rose back up and I started laughing with her. Right. And we were like just laughing.
She buoyed you. Yeah.
Yeah. She buoyed me. She saved me.
Yeah.
And then I felt great. And we ended up joking about my mom and laughing, you know, later. It was like night and day.
What a different experience to have from the first story.
Absolutely different. So those are my, now looking back, it just makes sense. Those are my personal, you know, substantiations for what shareable is bearable.
Right.
What causes our depression and our anxiety and all the other things, the mania, the panic attacks, is anger, especially feelings of abandonment and betrayal. And what do we do with the anger? The first thing is we find someone to get it for us and with us, to be angry with us and for us on our behalf, to validate our feelings, because what's shareable is bearable. And that's the secret. That's the trick.
Right. And like you were saying before, that doesn't have to be a therapist, right? It can be.
I mean, my daughter was 16 and all she did was look at me and laugh with me at the absurdity of it. So no.
Right.
It doesn't need to be a therapist. And unfortunately, there's a lot of therapists who don't know what I'm saying.
Right.
And they're not going to do this. And so you go to them and you start talking about the absurdity of your mother and how she did these things to you. And the therapist might even defend your mom.
Right. Right.
So are they validating your feelings or are they completely invalidating your feelings and making you more depressed and anxious?
Right. It's so important to be validated, isn't it?
Feelings aren't right or wrong, good or bad. They're feelings, but we're not made to feel them alone.
Right.
And if your therapist leaves you alone in your feelings, that's more betrayal. That's more emotional abandonment than you already have. So they're kind of exacerbating the problem.
Right. So therapy can make things worse.
It can.
When
and
it's with
yeah.
someone who's
yes.
not properly trained. Or not even trained. Trained's not the right
yeah.
word. Doesn't have the full...
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I was going to say, so going back to my graduate program where I met Caroline, we have similar therapeutic modalities. Okay. And that's what we talked about yesterday on the phone is we both were kind of making fun of CBT and DBT together on the phone. And she what she said is she gets clients who come to her after going to a CBT therapist and say, oh, wow, thank you for just listening and empathizing and validating, you're just human and it feels so good to be with another human.
Right. What did you share with her your thoughts about anger and how
yeah.
and what did she think about that?
Yeah.
She agreed.
She absolutely agreed. And yeah. And it was great. And we hopefully we're gonna stay in touch and get more connected. And we will have a lot to share. But what I wanted to share was this other woman who we went to graduate school with. She was our age as well. Mm-hmm. And I will never forget this. So she did not ascribe to our therapeutic modality, which is just, it's not only hearing people and empathizing and validating. That's not all we're doing.
Right.
But that's a key part. And one of these other graduate students, she was a woman and she, I remember her sharing, she was a big mindfulness proponent, this woman.
Okay.
And I remember how she was sharing that her son who I believe was like an older teen, maybe 17, 18 years old, was struggling with depression.
Okay.
And she was sharing, and she started tearing up actually while she was sharing with us in this class, how hard it was for her to see him struggle with depression. Like, he wasn't getting off the bed for a while. You know, it was bad.
Right.
And she was trying her mindfulness efforts on him. And so he was on the bed, not getting off the bed. And she said, "Son, don't you see how the bed, just feel the bed, feel the bed on your skin holding you." Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking at that time, and this is, you know, when we were just starting out as interns, as trainees, I remember just in my gut intuitively going, "No, no, 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 no. That's not what your son needs from you as his mother when he's depressed." And I remember thinking, she's one of those therapists who doesn't see depression as relational.
Right. Right.
But she's his mother. And I remember instinctively wanting to say to her, "No, no, no. What he needs is for you to go sit on the bed, wrap your arms around him, and say, 'Tell me how you're feeling, and tell me everything right now that makes you angry, even if some of that is things you're angry at me with.'"
Right.
I remember instinctively just wanting to say that to her.
Right. Do you think why, like, what do you think someone like her, if her viewpoint isn't that depression is relational, what does she think it is? You know, what is, I mean, I know you can't speak for her, but.
I mean, I don't think most therapists think any mental illnesses are relational. I mean, they'll say like, "Oh yeah, personality disorders are attachment disorders." And so we'll think of those as those start in the first few years of life because we're taught that.
Okay.
But I don't think most therapists, I don't think most psychologists, psychiatrists.
So do they think it's like organic, like just brain chemistry?
People will say it's organic brain chemistry.
Okay.
Yeah. Which it can be brain chemistry, but that doesn't mean it's still not based in a relational trigger.
Right. Right.
It does. My thing is, guys, it doesn't just happen out of nowhere.
No.
It's not an infectious disease.
Right.
You didn't go to the store and catch a bout of depression.
Right.
You didn't go to school and catch a bout of anxiety or panic disorder. It doesn't just happen. It comes from somewhere, and it's always relational. Mm. And if, as a society, we're going to pretend it doesn't, then we're all going to struggle with mental illness, all of us.
Right. Oh, wow. That's really a lot.
Yeah. How are you feeling right now?
Oh, that just feels like it's a lot to think that people are running around trying to not be depressed, do all these things to fix it. But if they're not getting to the heart or the root of it, then it's just like putting Band-Aids on.
It's exactly putting Band-Aids on it. And it's funny too, because, I mean, like I said, I like, you know, we all want people to engage in healthy behaviors like exercise and getting outside in nature and being more social, like, which is, again, part of the behavioral therapy.
Right.
But what I found is that when my clients start externalizing their anger and their feelings of abandonment, betrayal, and anger into words with me and feeling validated and getting that anger out of their bodies, and then creating assertiveness and boundaries with the healthy anger and channeling it in those ways, once they start doing that, then all of a sudden, in the next session, they're telling me, "I started gardening and I love gardening," or, "You know what? I'm going back to the gym for the first time in 10 years. I love it. I don't need to tell them to do those things."
Right.
Or, I started eating more healthy and I'm looking into all these recipe blogs, and it just comes naturally when you're feeling better. And what I find with the CBT approach, those therapists are like, you need to eat better. You need to exercise. They're telling these depressed people.
Right.
They're putting the cart before the horse. People will naturally do those things when they're feeling better.
Right. Right. Doing those things. They're right.
But they won't do it when they're depressed as hell. Not for long.
No.
They might, because you tell them to, for a week or two.
Right. And why do you think that is? Do you think it's just they naturally want to do things that make them feel better?
Yeah.
Because they're feeling better?
Yeah. I mean, that's been my personal experience. Even calling Caroline, who I haven't talked to in probably 7 years, you know, I reached out to her just last week. You know, I found her on Psychology Today and I sent her an email and I said, hey, let's chat. Like, it's been a long time. And
right.
I did that because I was feeling really great and I want a healthy friendship in my life. I want another healthy friendship. But when I was at my most depressed, if my therapist just told me, you should reach out to Caroline, she would be a good friend. When you're depressed, you just can't do things like that and you don't want to. And I don't think we would have had a good friendship because I was too depressed to even be a fun person to talk to at the time.
That's so true. Yeah.
What are you thinking right now? Are you thinking about yourself or reflecting on anything?
Yeah, I am. So I've been reading this book that I think I must have heard about on NPR or maybe on the New York Times or something. And it's this book called How to Keep House While Drowning. And it's really interesting. And there was a link in it to a website about, what was it? Practicing self-compassion, which I guess is a, sorry. Practicing self-compassion, which is, I suppose, is a component of mindfulness.
Yes, it is.
Right.
Yeah.
And I've heard of self-compassion for 20 years. I've heard that term.
Yes, it's been a big
trend. And it's
trend.
And it comes from Buddhist practices, I think.
I think so.
Is where it comes from, originates. And I've heard it. And of course, yeah, it's like one of those things that you're like, oh, yeah, of course you should be like nice to yourself, right?
Yeah.
But I never really thought about it.
Yeah.
It never really like clicked in my head. Like, what does that mean? And I started thinking about it. And then I went into the website and then I found an audiobook to listen to. I watched the TED Talk of this person. And her name's Kristen Ness.
Oh, I've read
one
of her books. Okay. Yeah.
And I watched her TED Talk and it was really interesting. And it was about the difference between self-esteem and self-compassion.
Yeah.
And it really was like, oh, that's very interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea that, you know, we all think having healthy self-esteem is good, right? And she doesn't say it isn't good, but of course it can be negative because it can lead to narcissistic behavior, too much self-esteem. But the trouble with self-esteem is that when you don't succeed, you don't have it, right?
Yeah. It's a metric.
Right.
That you're always having to
To reach, right? Mm-hmm. And always trying to keep up. That's true. Always comparing yourself.
That's true.
Always, always, always.
Got it.
And even if you're not even like a so-called status-oriented person, you know, like you're not in the world of finance or whatever, you know, you're just a housewife. In your mind, you're still always comparing yourself to someone.
Yeah.
And how self-compassion is sort of a different way of looking at yourself And I'd never really thought about that, there's all this negative self-talk going on in my head.
Mm.
And that's not a new thought. I know that. But I never really thought about how it's like constantly going in my head.
Mm.
And that, that's like, and she talks about that, how we tend to do that. We try to motivate ourselves by being mean to ourselves. Mm. Like, oh, if you don't clean the kitchen, then you're lazy, right? You know, come on, get up and clean the kitchen. And so, just realizing that I've been trying to motivate myself with negativity for 20 years.
Okay.
And
yeah,
it's never worked. It doesn't really work. It's kind of like what you said, where the therapist says, oh, you should really exercise or you should eat better. And you're like, oh, okay, you do it for a little bit. And then you're like, oh, I'm exhausted. I give up. I can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just kind of this little like switch in my perceptions of myself and how much less like exhausted I feel when I'm not like putting myself down all the time.
So the self-compassion has been helpful for
you. Yeah, it's helped me just kind of a different way of like framing things for myself. And it's just like what you said about it's made me feel better, even though nothing is different. It's made me feel better enough to want to make better choices. Like you're doing, like she talks about doing things as like a gift to your future self.
Hmm.
Like instead of doing that because so-and-so will approve of me or I will be better. I will be a better person if I do blah, blah, blah. It's like, no, I know that future me will be happy that I like picked up the house last night before I went to sleep, right? I mean, these are just silly things. This kind of goes back to the book about keeping a house. But these have been things I have really struggled with being a stay-at-home mom.
Mm-hmm.
And just sort of seeing myself in this different light so that I think I can start to look at all the things you've been telling me about anger and who am I angry at and what am I angry about?
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't even been able to like allow myself to really look at those things because I'm so busy berating myself.
Being angry at yourself.
Being angry at myself for just daily life things.
Yeah.
And being, I think, being like emotionally exhausted by that.
I see.
And
That's a cycle.
Yeah, it's a cycle.
Yeah.
And it's been going on for a long time. And so I haven't been able to like get myself up out of this thing. Yeah. And I feel like this little shift is helping me see myself in a totally different way.
I believe that.
Yeah.
And I think it's not a little shift. It's the shift.
Maybe it is the shift. Yeah. It's like, oh my gosh, what if I didn't like constantly say bad things about myself. It's amazing. It's kind of like, wow, I'm okay the way I am. Like there's nothing wrong with me the way I am.
Yeah. You're human.
I'm human and
I don't have to abandon myself.
No. Like I don't and I don't have to wait till I'm whatever, until I accomplish this or that, or until I lose 15 pounds or whatever. Have the right shoes or whatever stupid thing, you know, just it sounds so dumb, but
yeah,
just these little things that were keeping me from moving forward.
I believe that one of the things I do with my clients is, and it's experiential, it's considered experiential therapy if you want to have a name for it. But I will oftentimes have my clients, they'll be telling me about, or I'll just kind of have an understanding of what their childhoods were like. So I'll pick a memory. Maybe it'll be the memory they're talking about the moment. So I'll say, okay. So for example, when, you know, when your mom was berating you for being fat when you were five, can you picture little Katie?
Right.
I know this wasn't you, of course, yes, but I'll just say Katie.
Sure.
And then they'll say, yeah. And I said, would you be okay to engage in an exercise right now?
Okay.
And they'll say, usually yes. And say, okay, can you close your eyes and picture little Katie when she was five and her mom is berating her for being fat? And then they'll start tearing up and saying yes.
Right.
And I'll say, what was the look on her face? And then they'll tell me, well, she looks confused. She looks alone. She looks ashamed. And I'll say, can you, adult Katie, move towards her and get down on her level and look her in her eyes right now? And then they'll say, yes.
Yeah.
And I'll say, can you tell her right now? Can you just talk to her? And can you tell her, you know, little Katie, mom has taught you that your value and worth come from how you look. But I want you to point to mom right now. Adult Katie's going to point to mom. Mm-hmm. And you're going to look at little Katie and say, see that woman that looks like an adult on the outside? Your mom?
Right.
She's no older than you are on the inside. And little Katie, you're not the problem. She's the problem. She's really confused about what matters. And she really doesn't understand the truth. And then I want you to say to little Katie, what matters is that your value and your worth are inherent. They're innate. You can't add to them and you can't detract from them. From the day you were born, your value and worth were there and they're unshakable. And I want you to know from this point onward that I will not abandon you.
Right.
If you look big or too small or any other way. I will not go anywhere. I am here now. And I'm sorry that I have abandoned you and I have put you down and I have humiliated you,
right,
and shamed you. And I want to promise you that that's not going to happen anymore. I am going to advocate and value your needs and your feelings from here on out. I am going to make them a priority. From here on out, I am committed to you. And I will never abandon you again.
Right. Yeah. In the audiobook I was listening to, she talks a lot about like thinking about yourself as a child, right? And how you would only want good things for that child, right? And it's like, it's so interesting how we can show so much compassion and concern for others, but be so unkind to ourselves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We abandon ourselves.
We do.
Glennon Doyle is the one who...
right. Oh, so much of this made me think about Glennon Doyle.
Yeah. Really? Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's when I first read it. And when she said, we abandon ourselves, I was like, oh my God, that is exactly what we do. And I just needed her to put that into words for me.
Right.
And then, you know, I'm a big fan of the Bible Project. Tim Mackey from the Bible Project at one point said that he likes to frame it that humans will be in exile from themselves.
Right. Right.
So it's a self.
And that sounds like C.S. Lewis too, doesn't it?
Self-exile.
Ugh.
Where we exile ourselves and are exiled from ourselves.
And that we somehow think that by doing those things, we're going to shame ourselves into being better. Or...
So again, depression and anxiety and all these things are the root is relational. The root is feeling rejected or abandoned or betrayed by someone that we trusted and loved or needed. But I think the solution is relational too.
Right.
And it doesn't mean repairing the relationship with our mother or father, or whoever, you know, abandoned us to begin with.
Right.
It's the healing, the resolution is restoring that relationship with ourselves.
You're right.
It's relational at the core, because humans are relational at their core, and we have a relationship to ourselves.
You're right. I didn't even think about that.
And that's the shift that you're seeing in your life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just been in the last week that I came upon this stuff, you know, just coincidentally, serendipitously. Mm. It's like, wow. It's making me look at everything differently. And it makes me feel a lot stronger, too.
Does it? Like,
yeah.
How so?
Because I just don't feel, I mean, I had a few pretty good days this week. And then yesterday, I wasn't feeling as confident or as in good relationship with myself. Mm. But I was able to like see myself, kind of like how you talked about sinking down, the depression, feeling of sinking down. I could feel myself sinking down.
Mm.
But then I was able to like look at it and be like, oh, I'm feeling something.
Mm.
I can see it. Mm. It doesn't feel very good, but I can feel it and I can let it.
That's right. Because you talked about how you're able to feel your feelings instead of self-distracting like you used to.
Right.
Got it.
Right. And that's new for me. I'm the master of distraction.
Yeah.
And feelings. And yeah, I was able to feel it. And it wasn't nice, but, and then it passed. And then I was okay.
I love that. Yeah. And along with that, I want to invite you next time you have a hard feeling.
Right.
But shareable is bearable.
Okay.
And if you don't feel comfortable sharing it with your husband, Steve, who's also named Steve, I'm here for you. You can just reach out to me.
Okay.
You do that for me.
I will.
You got high praise from me for doing that for me.
I will.
You always validate my feelings, and I will do that for you.
Okay.
I won't charge you a penny.
Free therapy.
Well, you're my free therapy.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. All right.
Well, I think we should wrap up here. What do you think?
I think so. Good place.
Yeah. This was great. Wow. Well, thank you guys for listening. A lot was said today, and we have yet a lot more to say. So thanks for listening today. And I hope that you can have lots and lots of takeaways from this as you just let it percolate in your brain over the next week or so. All right. Bye-bye.